Hey everybody, a few quick things before the episode starts. I've got a bunch of them, so I'll go through them as quick as I can. One, this is an ICVA episode, which means the quality is not the same as normal. You'll notice it's just a little bit more echoey or cavernous. We're doing it in a hotel room, so quality's good, it's just it'll sound a little bit different. It won't be as strong as normal. Other things, we have another big announcement coming later today, at least the day which we drop this. I won't say anything more than that. It's just going to be really cool. So do look for that. It'll go up, I don't know when exactly, but it's going up at some point. The other two things, one is on Monday, if you have not already heard, we are recording live our 200th episode. It's a huge number. This is 199, so you still got a couple days to go, but Monday, 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we will post on Twitter and on the blog links to where you can actually watch the stream. This will also be available in MP3 form a little bit later in the week, but in any case, you can watch live at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll be doing it probably for about 2 hours. There's going to be some cool stuff, like there's some trivia. We're going to talk about sort of our experiences with the show, and we'll do a discussion about world science fiction, which should be really cool. So that's that. And then the last thing is about the Worldcon fundraiser. Right now we have about $820 in there. That's obviously very far away from the final goal. What I'm going to say right now is basically the only thing that matters is getting enough funds for the airplane ticket. Because the longer we wait in airplane tickets, the more expensive to get, and the more difficult it's going to be to raise that kind of money. The food and that kind of stuff, not going to matter so much right this immediate moment, at least in April. So what I'm going to say is basically we need to get enough for the airplane ticket. Right now, I think I can get a ticket for maybe $1,200 to $1,400, I think. I saw one for $1,250 recently, so that's very possible. So that means we need to get maybe $600 to $700 more bucks in there. That means we really need you. That's, 100 people at $10 is well over that amount. So any little bit you can give, even if it's only $5, please do consider doing that. Go to skiffyfanny.com. You'll see in the right, there's a GoFundMe little app thingy there. It'll take you to the page. There's perks, that kind of stuff. So do please donate, and we'll deal with some other stuff later that has to do with fundraising stuff. As long as we get the plane ticket, that pretty much sets everything in motion. And on that note, I think that's it. So I'm going to shut up. I'm going to let you get to the episode. I really hope you enjoy it. And we'll see you on Monday, 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Look for the links.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3. 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show. I'm Sean.
I'm Julia.
I'm Kathy.
And our special guest today is Sophia Samathar. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, real quick, we want to start off because I've been tweeting to you via Scary DM, and we finally arranged for you to be here. And you had a book come out last year, so I was hoping you'd start by telling us a little bit about.
Stop. She did not just have a book coming out last year. She is the Crawford Award winner. We are at ICFA, where this is award is, yeah, so.
That too?
This is major. She's like the awesome sauce person of this con right now.
And also, I'd just like to point out, it has recently been nominated for the Nebula, I believe.
Yes.
Yes, it has. Awesome.
Yes, and although I don't share all of my nomination details, I will say that I did nominate it for the Hugo. So this is like privileged information. I don't.
Thanks,
I don't
Julia.
Share all of my nomination details, but I did. I did put that in my Hugo notes.
Well, okay. Well, since all that came out, tell us a little bit about. Actually, just to start off, tell us a little bit about yourself. Kind of your how you came into the writing world. I hear you're also an academic.
Yeah, I am. Actually, like many people at ICFA, I'm one of those people who, you know, does academic work and also does creative work. How did I come into the writing world? Well, after I came into the writing world, I found out that I did it wrong. Because I have met so many people who, A, have done some kind of workshop, like Clarion or Odyssey workshop, and B, who have you know, published quite a bit of short fiction and then had a novel come out after. And I've in fact been told, you know, it's too late for me, but I've been told that that's actually the way you're supposed to do it. So I did the opposite. I didn't publish anything until the novel was under contract with Small Beer Press. And I was a complete unknown. And at that point, I was in graduate school, getting my PhD, and I didn't feel that I really had the concentration for a novel anyway. So I started writing poetry, and then short stories. And I thought, well, it would be a good idea to put some of these things out so that when the novel comes out, I'm not just a complete, you know, what. So that's how I came into the writing world, I guess.
Now, if I recall correctly, your degree was in African languages and literature, specifically Swahili, correct?
I started out with Swahili, and then I switched. Well, I had a weird academic career, too, because I did my MA, and I was a Swahili major, and then I hated everything about academia, and I was like, this is awful, I'm leaving. So I left, and I thought I was never going to make the sad face because I came back. But some people will make sad faces about that. But So I left, and I thought I was never coming back, and I had 12 years where I was teaching English as a second language, and teaching a bit of English literature as well, first in Sudan, in what is now South Sudan, and then in Egypt. So that was 12 years, and then I thought, you know, I'd really like, first of all, I'd like to go back to the U.S., and secondly, I'd like, you know, to do something that would make use of what I've been doing so far. So I went back at that point, but no longer with Swahili as my major language. I switched to Arabic as my major language. So, I loved it. When I came back and did the PhD work, you know, being in school again and all of it, I just absolutely loved it. So, yes, so and I went back to the same program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So my degree is in African languages and literature, but now in the end with a focus on Arabic.
Interesting.
Okay. So you've got a lot of experience with African literature, I'm assuming. What are the things that we're doing? One of the things that we're doing this year on the Skipping Fantasy Show, as advertised on this T-shirt, is we're kind of like exploring SF and fantasy from around the world. Ooh. And so I was wondering what your experience of the fantastic in African literature has been, like whether historical or present, anything at all if you want to share with us.
Well, sure. Yeah. I did my dissertation on the amazing Sudanese writer Tayyip Saleh, and the dissertation title is Non-Standard Space, Tayyip Saleh, Fantasy and World Literature. So I actually did a fantasy kind of, that was what I was looking at. And I looked at some other writers, Ibrahim Alkoni from Libya, who, if you are in a group of people who study Arabic literature and you say magic realism, somebody will say Ibrahim Alkoni within, like, you know, 30 seconds. I mean, he is the writer that leaps to mind immediately. Very beautiful, sort of, to me, I mean, the novel that I looked at is called The Bleeding of the Stone, which is a novel that I also... I'm teaching now, and it really has kind of it has the shape of a fable, and it's environmentalist literature, really. It's about, you know, relationship between people, animals, and the desert, to the point of, you know, a human being transforming into a wild sheep. So very, very fantastical. Tayyip Saleh, I looked at these elements in his work too, and then I looked at Ben Okri from Nigeria, who's the other one that, you know, when people talk about Africa and magic realism, his name comes up a lot. And I looked at Bessie Head.
Interesting.
Yeah, who I looked at A Question of Power. And there it's fantasy, I mean, it's framed in a different way because the character is experiencing a breakdown, and so her fantastical visions are meant to be understood as, you know, as the result of that. And yet, at the same time, you know, I thought, you know, sort of interesting to look at what those elements are doing anyway, even though it's supposed to be very clear that, you know, this is not real.
Interesting. Yeah, I taught, not this year, but I have taught a Bessie Head short story, the title of which is now escaping me.
Hmm.
Somebody may remember it, but it's the one where it's talking about these during apartheid prisoners and the trouble they get into with one of the wardens, and or not the warden, the guard guy, whatever you call it, whatever his title is, and they basically decide to manipulate him because he's like this really hard ass, and he's not like any of the other people that they've ever had, and so they manipulate, find out that he's a hypocrite, and use it against him to sort of get a better scenario. Like, they know they're in prison, they're going to serve their time, but they're going to do it with a guy who's not a jerk.
Huh.
That's kind of a really horrible reduction, but it's a really interesting look at the apartheid through the metaphor of a prison system.
Yeah,
it's really good. But I didn't know that she'd written something more deliberately fantastic.
I mean, like I said, it's not supposed to be, it doesn't have any of the kind of ambiguity of magic realism. It is very much like, she's ill, and this is why she is seeing these things. But it's still, it's a fascinating book.
Excellent.
And she's she's a fascinating writer. I'd like to see more written about her. I'd like to write about her myself more.
You are an academic now.
Yeah.
So your book, A Stranger in Alondria, it deals a lot with language. And I wondered if you would maybe talk a little bit about, how did you come to write that? Does it tie in with the things that you've studied?
Mm-hmm. It definitely ties in with the things that I studied. In fact, when I started working on A Stranger in Alondria, I had already written my MA thesis on Tayyip Saleh, and that thesis was on his great novel, Season of Migration to the North. And that book, which deals with, issues of post-colonialism, travel, exile, and education, was a huge influence on A Stranger in Alondria, where I also am looking at all of those same themes. And language, certainly. Now, the language thing, I mean, I just love words. So I come at the language thing from all my different angles of love, if that makes sense. So one of them is, and I've talked about this before when I've talked about the novel, kind of the tension between oral and written ways of knowing that you have going through the novel, which was very much related to what I was doing when I was writing it, which was teaching English in South Sudan. So an area where, things really operated according to an oral mode more than a written one. There was actually very little to read in the town where I was. There was just almost no reading material. There was no newspaper. The books were the books that we had at the school and the books that we had in our house. So, and the Bible.
Of course.
Yeah. So writing was just a really fringe, writing and reading was a really fringy thing there. But I was there, my role was to make it not be so much on the fringe anymore. My role was to, again, this was the Civil War at that time was still going on. I was working in one of the so-called liberated areas, which means it was no longer under control of the government of Sudan. So my students had done the first part of their education in Arabic, actually, and were now switching to English. So this was a really big deal that English was coming in, and they, English was going to be, an official language of the country that they were looking forward to at that time. So that's a great thing to be part of. And at the same time, it's quite disturbing to be part of a shift toward English as a lingua franca and a shift toward toward reading and writing and reading and writing in English as the means of expression. So those tensions really come out in the novel. But then the other kind of, just love of words thing is that, I'm a huge Tolkien fan. And, I grew up, The Lord of the Rings I still kind of think is the best thing ever. And certainly, through all the time I was growing up, it was just the idea that you would go and make a world that was so rich and you create your own language for it was just amazing. Now, I didn't do anything as extensive with the Alondrian language or Kideti, which is the other language in the book, nothing close to what Tolkien has done. But I at least know what all the words mean. I know what all the names mean. I know what all the place names mean and all that.
And I felt like reading A Stranger in Alondria, one of the things it captured, besides the joy of learning and the joy of actually getting a handle on understanding texts, was the world itself. It's one of the things that I've read that captured the feeling of going to another country that's not your own and falling in love with it, despite the fact that it's not where you're from. And it was, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the tension I sensed in the, I can't remember his name.
Djevik,
yes.
Yeah.
In Djevik, because he falls in love with Alondria, but there is that tension about needing to go home and wanting to go home, but still being in love with this other country.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about if that was influenced by your travels, or if it was influenced by a season of migration to the north.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think certainly Tayyip Saleh's novel is addressing those issues of where is home exactly. And for me, you know, so I wrote the first draft of the novel in Sudan, and then I kept working on it while I was in Egypt, partly because I couldn't find an agent, so I couldn't get it published, so why not keep working on it? But that's another whole sad, that's another whole sob story. But it was while I was in Egypt that I realized that when I said home, what home meant was wherever I was not at that particular time. So when I was in Egypt, I would talk about, oh, going home for the summer. And then when I was in the U.S., I'd be like, when I go home, meaning Egypt. And that really kind of struck me as, like, I still don't know what to think of that. Like, it seems like there's something wrong about that, then, because people are always like, home is where the heart is, and I'm like, well, home is the place that I'm not in right now, and that, you know, I think I would like that not to be the case. And I'm now in a position where I've just moved. I mean, I haven't even been for a year in the place where I am now, so it's not really home yet, but I'm hoping that it'll get there, and that at some point home will be the place where I am.
That's interesting, because I've had a lot of experience, like, moving to different places, and basically, I grew up in Southern California and hated it, so I spent my first 18 years trying to figure out how to get away from there,
mm-hmm.
and I went to Maryland, Indiana, and France, and then I kind of came back to Northern California and eventually landed in Boston,
mm-hmm.
and at this point, Boston feels like home, but every other place, I felt like I was there, and there wasn't really a home. Like, I would talk about going home wherever I wasn't, in every other place. But every time I would leave a place and it would be time to say goodbye to that place, I would think, there's a part of this place in me now, and I'm always going to miss it.
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
It's kind of, I think that's one of the things that really appeals to me about your book, is it really captures that sense of sort of like loving certain things but having the tension and never quite feeling like it's perfectly a fit.
Yeah.
But still being able to love it.
Yeah, and neither place is a perfect fit. I mean,
mm-hmm.
certainly for Djevik, I think, you know, he finds a way to live. But, and for Lunre, his teacher as well,
mm-hmm.
who has, you know, who moves from Alondria to the Tea Islands, it's also like, you know, you make your home in the new place, but you're not, you know, you're still really formed by that other place.
Definitely. So you said you didn't start publishing short stuff until after you'd already contracted with Small Beer for the novel.
That's right.
That's worked out pretty well for you, because right now you're nebula nominated for a short story as well.
Yes, that is true. Selfie stories are for losers, which amazes me, because and you know, I'm completely delighted. That's a story that I'm very happy with. I'm very happy that it found a home at Strange Horizons. Speaking of home.
Well, we were super happy that you sent it to us, because we immediately, that It doesn't happen very often that all three of the editors, we always have to agree on every story we buy, and usually we have a lot of conversations about each story, but every once in a while, one story will come through, and all three of us, when we have the meeting, we're like, I want to buy this, and that's what we say. And then we have a conversation about why we love it, but that was, like, the story for us. When that happened, we all got it, we're like, I want to buy this.
That's always good.
Yeah, that's very really good, especially because, you know, I consider myself more naturally a novelist and a poet than a short story writer. And, you know, Selkie Stories is one of the first short stories of mine that I have liked. I usually hate them with a passion. And since then, I've written a couple more that I like.
How about the one that you wrote for Kaleidoscope?
I love that story.
Because she's got a story coming out in Kaleidoscope, which is the anthology I'm co-editing with 12th Planet Press.
Plug.
Well, I figure I should explain it, though. But yeah, so we solicited a lot of people that we thought might, because the theme is diversity, and we solicited a lot of people who we thought might give us good stories that were YA diverse stories, and Sophia just, like, immediately turned around. Sophia and Ken Liu both, like, within a tiny fraction of time. It was like we asked, and the next day there was this perfect story waiting in our inbox.
I don't know if it was quite that fast in my case, but you know, I think it was a really exciting opportunity to think about. I just think it's really important, you know, to have an anthology, a YA anthology, that's going to be, you know, that expressive of so many different perspectives. So, yeah, I was excited about the project. And I do like, that's one of the stories that I like.
So tell us about that story, because I'm not going to talk about it, but you can tell whatever you want.
Okay.
About it.
About Walk Dog.
Yeah.
Yes, it's called Walk Dog. I was actually just thinking about it the other day, because it's a high school story, and it's very much based on my own school experience in South Orange, New Jersey. And, you know, it's hard. High school is so hard, at least it was for me. And so it's a story about, and actually a lot of my stories, and the novel as well, A Stranger in Alondria, they're often about complicity. Complicity with things that you do not believe in. That you completely disagree with and would like to see destroyed. Complicity with systems that you are born into and you want to change, and how difficult it is to do that. And Walk Dog, I think, you know, it's a story about bullying and about the position of people who are bystanders. And who, by being bystanders, are being complicit. And the idea that you need to walk with others. You need to walk with others. Because what creates your feeling of powerlessness when you're complicit is that you feel alone. You feel like there's nobody else who's trying to go against this thing, and I know it's wrong, but I just don't have anybody with me. And yet, you know, you've got to try and find those other people who are also opposed.
That seems really fascinating. I look forward to it, because I have not gotten to read it yet.
It is a brilliant story. It's also heartbreaking.
I don't want to give any spoilers, so I was just super vague.
Yeah,
like,
no,
systems, complicity, opposition, because I'm trying not to say anything that happened in the story.
Bit about the format, because it's a very interesting style.
Oh, well, it's a paper. It's a paper that this high school kid is writing for her teacher. And so it's an assignment. And that was really fun, because it allowed me to kind of, you know, get into that voice of somebody who is really not that comfortable with writing a paper, but is trying to do what the teacher said, and is like, I know I'm supposed to include this and this, you know, so she's, and in a way, I think the form echoes that idea of, you know, your individuality and what you want to do, and then the forms that you're supposed to follow, And it's got lots of footnotes, which some people hate. I love footnotes. I adore them. I mean, the only person whose notes have been was David Foster Wallace, Infinite Jest. I have to admit, when I read that whole thing, and I was like, bro, 100 pages of tiny font and notes, I can't. So,
oh,
yes. I, when I, I think for the first, like, half of the novel, I kept on going and reading the notes, and then after a while, I was like, I can't do this anymore. But in general, I love footnotes. So I'm sorry for any listeners who are on the other side, because I know there are passionate people on the anti-footnote side of things.
I think that's the only story in the book that has footnotes. So if they're really anti-footnotes, they could skip it and they'd be missing out. But
no,
there's a whole other.
Well, I would say one thing that occurs to me is that both the theme of dealing with the complicity and also trying to fit in what you want to say in the confines of what the teachers are telling you is very, very indicative of high school and that feeling of being a teenager, because you're in between so many experiences where you're supposed to have power and do things, but you also are not allowed to have power in some circumstances.
Yes.
So it's an interesting tightrope walk.
It is. And actually, I kind of can't believe that you haven't read this story yet, because that's also really what this story is about. And at one point, the character says, we're adults. Like, if you look at, her teacher has told her at a different time period in history, they, at their age, would have been married and had kids and, been going to war and all this. And that also is what sort of makes high school a bit of a terrifying place, because people kind of, what the character in the story says is that people are allowed to act like kids, but they have the power to harm each other in adult ways. And that is also part of that tightrope that's really terrifying and has real, is extremely, extremely dangerous.
I'm thinking about high school as an interstitial space.
Yeah. Well, it is. It's very much like the teenage years are this false sort of area where everybody's telling you to be grown up and to act your age. But what is your age? Your age is the age that has to do what their parents tell them to, even though they are grown up.
Yeah.
Which is a really weird... And, you have to go to school and basically be, in my school, physically locked in for, 7 hours of your day, where they would close the gates and lock them, and you couldn't leave school grounds without someone unlocking the gate.
Mm-hmm. My high school was like that, too.
So, yeah, so it's like you are basically... You're an adult, except you are imprisoned, and you must do what other people who are actually adults tell you to do.
Mm-hmm. I should say my first high school, because I did go to two... I did switch to another school then. I went to a different school. But, yeah, started out very similar.
I don't know what that's like, to be locked in. That sounds horrifying. It seems like it's very counterproductive, because if you're trying to say, this is a good thing for you to do, get your education, it's not a prison. But we're going to lock you in.
I remember, I think I had... high school diaries where I would just write in there, I'm stuck and I'm in prison again. Because, I've been locked in, and the high school that I went to two different high schools. The second high school, I think they both had locking gates. But the second one had been built so that there were these long buildings that you would go inside, and there were long corridors, and the corridors had no windows. And so it was very dim, recessed lighting, and you'd walk down the corridor, and if it wasn't time to go into your class, the door would be locked, so you just wait in this dim cave-like corridor until the teacher opened the door. And there were no windows. I was okay, I'm going to go down into the dark cave in my locked campus and sit here and wait for the teacher to come. And I remember writing in my notebook, I'm in jail, waiting for the teacher to open the door.
Yep.
I never thought I was going to go into this interview and feel really good about my high school. afterward.
Win!
So win. I didn't get locked. No.
Well, I then transferred to, I for the final, 3 years of high school, I was at Lancaster Mennonite School as a boarding student, and I remember getting there, and they did not have locks on the lockers. They had lockers with no locks, and it blew my mind. I was just like, how is all their stuff not stolen? I don't understand this.
So they, just trust each other.
It
not
was
stealing.
Just, and you'd shut your locker, and you'd go click, click, but you wouldn't put a lock on it.
Weird.
And you'd go do your thing, and all your stuff would still be there. It was weird.
Talk about
science fictional. I mean, that was it was like a portal fantasy. Where
so, awesome. Mennonite, was it actually for Mennonite people?
It's a Mennonite school, and the vast majority of the students are Mennonite. Not all of them. Yeah, I am, though.
Because your mother is Swiss-German Mennonite.
You have done research. Yes. That is correct. Yes.
Yeah. And your father's Somali, if
yes.
I recall correctly.
Yep.
Yep. Just an interesting combination.
Yeah. I think there are 9 of us. Me
9
and my brother
Swiss
being 2.
Mennonite, German.
Somali, Swiss German Mennonite Somali combo. Yeah.
Not very many.
Yeah. There may be a few more, but.
Have you ever, this may be a no, but have you ever been to Somalia?
I have not.
Imagine it's very difficult to actually go.
Well, yeah, and when I was a kid, it was also, well, my dad was not welcome there under the dictator Siad Barre because he had given a pro-democracy interview on the BBC at one point.
Oh, well, that would
and
do it.
And so then he was not supposed to go there, so we never did. And then, you know, there was war.
Yeah. Jeez. I've been very interested, I mean, not just because, obviously, we had a Somali nominated for an Oscar for Captain Phillips, which whatever you think of that movie, but also, I mean, there's a really great rapper named Kane. Well, I guess he's sort of rapper Kanon.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar? Okay.
Absolutely, yeah.
Who actually does songs that are about Somalia and about
mm-hmm.
some of the things that have happened because he's a refugee as well.
Is he the one who did the water song with the water drumming?
I don't know.
Okay, there's
he did the song for the for the World Cup.
I'm pretty sure it's Kanon. Yeah, there's a song. It's a rap song about water. And the percussion, all the percussion is water drumming.
Hmm.
Is it? Oh, I love the water drumming in the background.
Yeah, he does some really interesting stuff, and
yeah.
His lyrics are very much. I mean, he does a song called Soba, which is all about just how his future has been taken away by these people who run Somalia. Yeah,
hmm.
It's very interesting to see that being discussed more, and it's not just talking about just to use the term people would use like that third world country over there, but we're actually having a conversation a little bit about some of the conditions.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the reason that those conversations are happening more in North America is because we have a lot more Somalis. I mean, when I was growing up, there was not really much of a Somali community in the United States, certainly nothing like what you have now.
Yeah, we have quite many of them now.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine fairly spread out, but then I think, I don't know, maybe they aren't so spread out.
Well, Minneapolis, St. Paul is...
is that the hub?
That's the hub. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I imagine with immigration, they must control where they go very...
It's not even so much immigration controlling, but I know a lot of people in immigrant groups want to go where there's people from...
Exactly.
Who also immigrate.
Yeah.
Just
exactly.
Shared experience.
Somebody who can
yeah.
understand
yeah.
where you're
and before
from.
You know it, you know,
yeah.
there you've got Somali restaurants, you've
yeah.
got mosques, you've got places where you can buy your stuff, and you've got family, and, you know, why would you
yeah.
go somewhere else?
Yeah. It's family and also, like, people who both speak your language and are already
yeah.
familiar
I,
with...
I feel like
yeah.
that would be a big thing, because I imagine not... If people coming from other countries, maybe even Somalia, may not even speak English or...
Some cases.
Yeah. And so that would be like, yeah, I don't know your language. It might be a good idea to have people.
Well, it's
that,
also nice
yeah.
to hear your. It's nice
right.
To
it's
hear
a culture group. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the things about like Native American groups is one of the arguments that there was actually a government paper about a couple decades ago, basically saying here's why people stay on the reservation, and it's because it's a cultural in-group. It's like there may be poverty on some of these reservations; they may not be great conditions, but it's like you're among people who know your language, they know your culture, you know, your family's there, those kinds of things. It's like it makes sense why you would want to be around other people.
Yeah. And you can see that, I mean, all over the country, right?
Mm-hmm.
All immigrant groups have always, you know, kind of congregated in different places.
Yeah, yeah.
Certain places, yeah.
That's,
I mean, we were talking last night with Jose Uriarte about Cuban Americans and the Cuban American population in Miami, which is where he grew up, and sort of the idea that the subculture is very important, and it's also the kind of thing that makes it so that there are a lot of different subcultures within U.S. culture that are still U.S. culture.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have a big Somali population in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and they can have Somali American culture, which is not the same as Somali culture.
Sure.
And it's still a viable U.S. culture.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really want, like, Somali food all of a sudden. I don't know what they have, what Somali food is, but I want it.
All right. Well, go to... I don't cook at all.
Oh
so
God.
I can't hook you up. I don't cook anything for you. But if you want to sort of, you know, do a kind of easy sort of Somalification of your plate, you can peel a banana and put the banana on the side by your food. and, like, cut up the banana and be eating the banana along with your food. Because that's a very traditional thing. And anyone can do that. Anyone can put a banana beside their food. And it's nice.
So how much of the Somali culture did you get from your father growing up?
I have no idea. I mean, I guess, well, two answers. One, I have no idea. And two, I'm guessing... No, I think maybe I just have to give one answer and say that I don't know because, you know, my dad was, you know, it was very different from my Mennonite side of the family because I went to Mennonite schools, I went to Mennonite high school and college, I went to Mennonite churches, I have lots of Mennonite friends. I was immersed in that culture in a way that I never was with Somali culture, and I just didn't know that many Somalis. I mean, obviously there would be, you know, friends and uncles and people that would come to the house. But I wasn't, you know, as a child, you kind of, you know, you go and say hi and you shake hands with everybody and then later you, like, bring the tea and nuts and then you kind of go because you're a child. Like, go away. The grown-ups are talking. So so I would say you can't, I don't know how much culture you can get from a single person because... As much as there are cultural elements that are going to be passed from any person to any other person, if it's only one person or a very limited number of people, there's the person's individuality as well. And then how do you separate those things? You can't really and decide which is which.
I totally get that. It's not an easy question. My father was from Mexico, so, like, I got some of what he wanted to share with me, but not a lot of it.
Yeah.
Because at the same time, he wanted us to assimilate,
mm-hmm.
so he wanted us to be properly American.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there were things that he would do, like, where he always wanted to make sure that I knew some of his favorite foods,
mm-hmm.
for instance. Like, he wanted to share that with his children to be
mm-hmm.
like, this is this awesome thing that I grew up eating, and I want you to grow up eating it, too.
Yeah.
Arroz con leche, which is just basic. It's kind of like rice pudding.
Yeah.
So that was one of his favorites. And horchata, he was really into the rice and cinnamon, which I have to say I am too, and it's horrible for me, so I should really not have it. Because it's like so sugary. Like, rice just converts directly into sugar, and so, like, my blood sugar spikes and then crashes, but I will, like, occasionally go, yeah, I'm going to have some anyway.
And I'll cry later.
Exactly.
It's a very good point. Like, besides the fact that it's hard to quantify, it's hard to get culture from a person because so much of culture is social.
Uh-huh.
And so you need to have a community.
Right, to reinforce quote-unquote values.
Because I suppose it's not really, I mean, it's not really a culture. It's what someone remembers of their culture. I mean, not that it's not really a culture, but it's like a lot of cultural practices involve who you're talking to and how you're interacting.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so it's hard to pass it on if there's not enough people to interact with.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
Although there is interaction between, you know, parent and child.
Yeah.
And there would be, you know, there are certainly cultural, you know, forms of parenting
yeah.
that maybe, you know, are some of the more recognizable.
Yeah. And there are other things that every parent does, and some of them will be personal, but some of them will be shaped by their culture that they want to, or even if they don't want to, that they automatically impose upon their children while they're parenting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, like, my father, for instance, wanted us to go to Catholic school, even though he was not religious, but he had gone to Catholic school growing up, and in his mind, this was the best education you could get.
Yeah.
So I had, like, for first and second grade, and my brother up through, I think, eighth grade, went to private Catholic schools, even though we weren't Catholic, which was
mm-hmm.
a very strange experience, but... But it was very much because this was his culture that he had grown up with.
Yeah. You know, this is so weird. Here's something I never thought of before about my own novel, A Stranger in Alondria. You know, there's a character, Tialan, who is the daughter of this priest, who is the priest of a very fringy, very powerful, because the king is their friend, but very fringy cult. And... So she's grown up sort of being the only kid
mm-hmm.
that belonged to that group, and they had all kinds of rules, and she was kind of just with her dad and didn't have friends and was an extremely lonely person, and I'm just sort of disturbing myself now by thinking of that as possibly an expression of, you know, being kind of not having a group or having a group that consists of you, just your dad, because that was actually her life.
Yeah, no, I think that's one of the reasons the book actually resonated so much with me is because I think I spent a lot of my younger years especially trying to figure out what group I actually fit into and not being able to tell. And so, like, in this book, there are a lot of people who don't quite fit here or there, and there's a lot of struggle for identity. And I think that is actually something I see through a lot of your work.
I completely agree. And if it wasn't there, I don't know, it would have to be written by a different person. Because, yeah, that's a huge thing. And I continue to think about it. I continue to think about it all the time because it's so complicated. There's so many pieces, you know. There's because, as Kathy was saying, it's social. So you can't just, like, make your own identity. As much as you're like, I'm just going to be me, you know, and you see that, like, on Saturday morning cartoons, in between, they have little messages about, like, just be yourself. But, like, who knows how to do that? Like, that's a terrible thing to tell a child to try to do. Like, it's a burden. It's pressure. Just be yourself.
They usually have ways in which you're supposed to be yourself.
This is also true. Yeah. But I think, you can't be yourself by yourself. And that means that you're always being read by a variety of different people. And, you know, depending on who you are, you could be, you know, read in really kind of bold ink where people are like, you are this. And that can really be a struggle if you are, you know, a human who is complicated.
Wow, so this is, I think, maybe a good place to start wrapping up. I have one last question for you before we actually, like, find out where to find you on the internet.
Okay.
that last question is, I think you mentioned several different African authors, but if our listeners wanted to start exploring the magical realism, because it seems like that's something that you particularly are interested in, from anywhere in Africa, what would be one specific first book that you would specifically recommend people to start with?
I had to make it one.
I am so ready for this. Thank you for that question. Okay, everyone needs to go and get Memoirs of a Porcupine by Alain Mabankou. Let me see if I can spell it. Mabankou. I believe that is correct. The last name. It is a beautifully written, incredibly strange story about a man and his double. And it is scary, and it's got some horror elements, and it's very stylistically amazing. So there you go.
Memoirs of a Porcupine.
Memoirs of a Porcupine.
I did want to say, so I have heard that there is possibly a sequel in the works for Stranger in
Alexandria. That's a good thing to bring up.
Yes, there is.
That to torture you.
There is possibly a sequel. And in fact, I mean, I have to be public now because I actually read from it yesterday.
Okay.
So I can't hide anymore. And I even revealed the title. The title is The Winged Histories. And it is almost done, and it is a series of histories told from different perspectives. This time it is not set between Alondria and somewhere else, it's all set within Alondria. And there is a character from A Stranger in Alondria who has a very important role to play in it, but it is not someone who was important, well, important, but not super important in A Stranger in Alondria. So there are links, but it also really goes off in a different direction. And it's almost done, and I'm hoping that Small Beer Press will want it. We'll see what happens.
Well, that's super exciting.
That's
so
great.
So it's one of those sequels, but because it's not picking up right after with the exact same characters, there's absolutely no reason not to go read Stranger in Alondria right now.
There you go.
Exactly.
I read it. Have you read The Palm Wine Drinker?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
I was just making sure.
Yes.
You
wouldn't want to let me out of this room, you know.
Without mentioning
without
Amos Tutuolo?
No, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was good call.
Yeah. Have you read?
No.
What? Have you?
I don't even know what this is, so you should probably explain.
Okay, Julia and Kefi don't get to
like,
read.
I think that a lot of the audience probably also doesn't, so maybe you
should
explain what it is.
Emma's Two Toilets, Palm Wine Drinker, it's usually sold in conjunction with another one, I forgot the name of the other tale, but it's basically like, almost like an African epic, but using a lot of sort of mythic and fairy tale references to the folklore. It involves a guy who's a palm who loves to drink palm wine, and he needs to find somebody who can tap it for him because he's out drunk everything, and he goes on this wild adventure and meets all these strange creatures and has a baby that eats everything and won't stop eating and keeps consuming and.
I feel like all of my friends who have recently had babies will really understand that.
Yeah. There's a lot of really cool stuff. There's like these weird head creature people that can like, they rent body parts to make themselves look into gentlemen, and then basically like, the implication is they're seducing, although it's not necessarily explicitly seduction. Seduce usually women and then take them back and imprison them.
So can you repeat the title and the author again?
Palm Wine Drinker by Amos Tutuola.
And, bonus, we should mention, because one of the guests of honor at ICFA this year is Nnedi Okorafor, and in Who Fears Death, there is a reference to the Palm Wine Drinker, which that novel has now become, in the futuristic setting of Who Fears Death, that is like one of their, you know, one of their cultural references from the ancient days. So that is a really cool connection.
Oh, man. So now I'm going to have to read Palm Wine Drinker and then reread Who Fears Death.
Yeah,
so
that
I will understand
my
it.
To
Palm
Wine
Drinker
totally
reads,
missed that reference.
It reads really quick because it reads almost like a children's fairy tale, except that the content is maybe less children-y. Well, maybe like in that old, like if I'm using a Western reference, but like Grimm's, like, you know, dark fairy tales.
Well, I think
those
stories were for everybody. They weren't for children. They were just for everyone.
No, I just meant like, but it has that style of like a fairy tale.
Yeah.
And it reads really quick, but it's really fun and just really exciting, the stuff that...
I'm on board even if it reads super slow. Like,
I'm just saying,
yes,
you can go read it now.
I need those people.
You can go out and find a store that's carrying a copy and read it before the end of tonight.
Okay, so on that
or
note... on that note, Sophia, where can we find you and your work?
I have a website. It's my name, sophiasamatar.com, and it has a writing page where there are all kinds of links to fiction and poetry online. I'm also on Twitter. I'm at Sophia Samatar. There's a blog that you can get to through the website. That's probably the easiest place to start.
Awesome. Which means you have to go buy Stranger in Alondria.
Starting with Sean.
Yes, you have to go to the book room and buy it.
Yeah, which is where I'm going to go.
Okay.
We've reached the shame Sean portion.
Yeah, every episode now has the shame Sean portion. Make him feel bad about himself, so he cries to sleep,
and then we
then you record his whimpers and put it on
YouTube.
We
throw him into the Hooters moat. Because I don't know if you noticed this, but next time you walk outside, if you pass that Hooters, there's a moat around it. I'm okay with everybody knowing that there's a moat around the Hooters now.
Okay. And on
Kefi's,
that note...
Kefi's like, they're recording. I'm like, if the Hooters puts a moat around it, I'm going to tell the world.
Okay. And on that note, awkward ending and scene.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus,
Shawnee Jen,
and or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.
Hey everybody, welcome to the World SF Tour, our special feature throughout the year in which we're obviously celebrating World SF. There are a number of ways you could support this show, just really quick. One is you could subscribe to the show. We're on iTunes, we have the blog, all that good stuff. There's all kinds of cool stuff on the blog too you should check out. That's one way you could support us. You can obviously let people know about us. That's really cool when people do that, link to us and all that good stuff. And the other way is actually to go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1 month free trial membership. You get a free audiobook out of the deal. You get to try their service if you like it, to keep it, which is cool. And yeah, I mean, that's really that simple. So that helps us as much as the rest of it does. But in any case, thank you for listening. I really hope you enjoy this year, this very specially themed year. And of course, if we missed anything, which we're undoubtedly going to do, feel free to let us know. Send us an email or leave a comment or something. Maybe even on some of our discussion episodes, you let us know about some great works from a certain region that we should be talking about. So in any case, I'll let you get to the episode, and I hope you enjoy it.